The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCunis. Back in 1995, I did my first interview with Amy Tan. She had just published her third novel, and it was really a pleasure to talk to her in person, in studio. But it almost began with a disaster. Amy arrived at the station with her dog, and her dog was Mr. Bubba Zoe. He was a 3-pound Yorkie, and he apparently was with her everywhere. He was inseparable. When she would get on a plane, Bubba Zoe would be inside her purse, very quiet. She wouldn't even tell the airline that she had a dog in her purse. And this is back in the day. You remember back in 1995 when you could walk on a plane without having them look in your carry-on or x-ray it? Well, little Bubba Zoe, he traveled everywhere with her. And she didn't tell Bubba before the interview that he wasn't going to be part of the interview. Apparently, this was the first time this had happened. She was going to leave Bubba out in the lobby with the publicist. Well, Bubba hadn't been informed. So as she walked into the studio, little Bubba tried to follow her. And we had these big, heavy airlock doors that would close very silently and very quickly and very heavily. And little Bubba just about got caught in the door trying to follow her. And I think it probably would have put a real damper on our interview if little Bubba had actually stuck his head through the door. But fortunately, he was curtailed, and I'm sure he's no longer with us, and he lived a long and happy life, little Bubba Zoe. And I'm glad it didn't end that day as Amy Tan came in to see me. Let's listen now to the best of the Book Nook. From an album called Songs of Sanctuary, that was Adiemus, and that particular tune was Tintinnabulum. Welcome to the Book Nook. My special guest today in the Book Nook is Amy Tan. Welcome.
Thank you.
You have a new book out. We have been waiting for this book. It's called The 100 Secret Senses. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, it's a story about two sisters and two cultures, two points of views about the world. A sister who thinks that she talks to ghosts and has memories of a past life, and another sister who's American-born and very much rooted in the idea that what you see is what you believe, as opposed to what you believe is what you see, which is what the other sister thinks. I think it more than a story of ghosts and past lives, which forms the backdrop to the story. To me, it's a story about love and how love influences what you hope and how those hopes influence or sometimes determine what you choose to believe.
And love isn't just happiness.
Right. Love can be all kinds of things. And I suppose for me and writing this book, I realized that the question I was asking myself is, what do I believe about love? What does it contain? What does it provide? What is it based on? What needs do we each have for love? What is unconditional love? During the time that I was writing this book, I'd often hear different friends talking about that issue. Either they were falling in love or they had reached a point in their marriages where things seemed to be settling into a groove that they weren't happy with, or they were getting out of marriages. And maybe look at that issue of, you know, the people that we meet in this world, are, that we end up being with, are they, is it all chance? Is it, was it destiny? You know, if people are newly in love, they're always saying it's destiny. We were walking along the same path in life, only it was a parallel path, and finally it met, you know. So it's all sorts of things about love, the endurance of love.
Some of us believe there are no coincidences. A lot of people were very excited to hear that you were coming on the program. I had a woman come up to me this morning, and she said, "The Chinese Siamese cat is such a wonderful story." And she told me the ages of her kids. A couple of them were almost teenagers, and they are always asking for this story.
Oh, well, that's wonderful to hear. I write, you know, I think it's certainly appropriate, you know, books that have pictures are appropriate for any age, really. I mean, as long as a person can focus on the picture and enjoy listening to a story. When I wrote that story, I read it to my niece, who at the time was about 4 years old, not quite four. And the fact that she could follow the story and knew the second time I read it to her what happened next was a good indication to me that it was right for even a very young child who couldn't read. And that story just, it came to me in a dream. My cat was about to die, or so I thought. She had feline renal failure. And, you know, I grieved and cried and all this. And then I had this dream about this cat, and I wrote the story. And my cat since then decided that, now that she was fairly well known, she might as well live and enjoy some of this. So she's still kicking, and she's 20 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
It's obvious you love animals. You came in with a friend.
Yes, I came in with a four-legged friend, also a two-legged friend. my friend, my very, very dear friend, Gretchen Shields, is with me on this book tour because she's also on book tour for her book, The Water Shell. And she's the one who illustrated the two children's books and also the covers of all three of my novels. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a cover on this new book.
Oh,
I was admiring it before you came in.
You know, when you look at it, too, it's very subtle. But if you look at it a long time, you realize there's this picture of the past that's in the background. And it's almost three-dimensional. And then the border around it is a little bit more modern, but has a lot of things going on it. And underneath there's a whole collection of good luck symbols that Gretchen put in there. We used to have these meetings about what good luck symbols we would put into the covers of the books. And then when the Joy Luck Club became a bestseller, I kept being asked this question, why do you think it became a bestseller? Well, I don't know. And finally I thought, well, I do know. And it was because Gretchen had put all these symbols in there that were supposed to be the subliminal message to the reader, buy this book. You know, buy this book and your children will go to the top three universities of their choice. So that is the only reasonable explanation I have for why it became a bestseller.
I can see why you keep using her illustrations.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
My guest is Amy Tan. Amy, the spirit world is a powerful influence in your writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot of people are skeptical of the spirit world. I myself, in past days, had my own doubts in that. My father died a couple of years ago, and I wasn't there when it happened. It was mm-hmm. kind of a shock.
Mm-hmm.
And he came to me in a dream shortly after that and told me a lot of things that I needed to know.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been a much stronger believer mm-hmm. in apparitions and spirits and, mm-hmm. and messages from mm-hmm. dreams. How has this impacted your own writing and your own life?
Well, I like a lot of people, I mean, especially if you're, you know, educated, you like dismiss things like that as being a little hokey, sentimental. But like you, I've had a number of experiences that have been so helpful that I almost had to look and say, well, even if it were not real in the sense that we define reality, what harm has there been in believing that that message, that help has come from somebody who you loved and, you know, are still very close to in some ways? I think ghosts are the ultimate metaphor, if they don't exist, the ultimate metaphor for the endurance of love. That if they are around, it's because they can't let go of the people they loved in this life. And if we believe in them, then it's because we don't want to let go of the love we had for them. And I have had certainly my share of the kind of wacky experiences of apparitions and sound effects. My house is plagued with quirky things like footsteps running up and down the stairs, door slams, things crashing, TV going on by itself and flipping channels, telephone hanging up, but only when I talk to my mother, colors changing on interior decorators, always something happening with interior decorators, you know, which makes me think that if there are ghosts in the house, they really hate interior decorators, and they must be, at least some of them, male. Whistling, the tune to Jeopardy. I put some of these things in the book just as a way for me to just have my own private joke, you know, and put that in. But far more seriously, I mean, I think that when I think about the possibilities of existence, what existence might mean beyond this physical realm, like you, I've had dreams. I've had a number of people close to me who've died. I've had dreams. I've had advice given to me, and I can't really describe them through the ordinary senses. I had, during the writing of this book, amazing coincidences that made me wonder, are they really coincidences, or am I receiving help, or what is really imagination? What happens when you open your imagination up, as you have to when you're a writer, and allow the possibilities of another world to come into your consciousness? I'll just give you an example. When I was writing this book, if I needed information, it would be literally handed to me. I had my setting for the part that takes place in China, a beautiful village I actually came across when I was filming the Joy Luck Club in China. Well, I knew that I wanted that setting, which was located in southwestern China, but I needed an interesting period of history to set the historical part. And it could have been in the, you know, some event that took place in another part of China, and I just moved my setting somewhere else. But I opened up the book, and suddenly, the first page I turned to, it was a section about the Taiping Rebellion, which I didn't know that much about, but saw it took place about 150 years ago, and it was a guy who thought he was the second son of God, you know, baby brother to Jesus, and led this revolution that almost led to the overthrow of the Manchu dynasty, or the Qing dynasty. Then, as I was reading further along, I saw that this thing actually started in a place in southwestern China, south of Guilin, in Thistle Mountain, which is where this village had been, this setting that I had stumbled across. I thought, oh, what a happy coincidence. I don't have to move my village. You know, and that's all well and good, you know, and things. But as I started writing again, you know, there were caves out there, and I thought, well, I need to know a little bit more about caves and archaeology. And then I'd receive a phone call, and I'd be invited that day to go to a reception in honor of the foremost archaeologist of China, an 85-year-old man. And there would also be 40 or 50 other archaeologists who worked in China. And, of course, you know, there were dozens of archaeologists then who knew exactly about this region of China and the possibilities of ancient prehistoric villages being found in caves. Another day I needed information about limestone formations and the Bernoulli effect. It's a kind of question maybe you wouldn't normally think to ask the typical person on the street. And I got a phone call, and somebody said, there's a writer in town. We're going to have a dinner for him. Do you want to come? I said, sure. That evening, I found myself seated next to a stranger, a man, an older man. He said he was a professor. And I said, what do you teach? And he said, geology. I said, really? Do you happen to know anything about limestone formations, rubble, and the Bernoulli effect? And he said, why, yes, I do. Limestone, that's actually a specialty of mine. These sorts of things, that are very serendipitous. And I started wondering, what do we call these things? Synchronicity, coincidence, serendipity, luck. I don't know, and I looked at this, and because it kept happening frequently, and then they became more bizarre and more specific, it was as though I could hear some sort of spirit laughing and saying, how many of these do we have to do before you believe that we are here as your ghost writers, so to speak?
Spiritual convergence. You keep trying to feel like it's a mistake or an accident.
Right, yeah. But, and in one sense, I can go back to a very rational point of view as a writer and say, when you write, it is the task of the writer to put together a number of details and seemingly disparate events and characters and find eventually a way to weave them together into a story. And the story has to have a thread of some kind, either an emotional one or a storyline one. And you find the thread, and that by the end of the story, you need to make that story appear, that all these events that happened earlier, if it's a good story, it should seem inevitable but not predictable. The thread of your story, at least of my stories, tends to be a question. These questions about love, the existence of love, the endurance of love. And with these questions in your consciousness all the time, naturally the experiences that happen to you during the day, as well as memories you may have that float to the surface, go through this question like a sieve. And, of course, everything then seems to be related because you have forced it through the focus of a question. On the one hand, I could say that is in part one way that imagination works. If you direct it to a specific channel, you will find those connections. Or you could say that the connections have always been there, and you're only aware of it when you let your imagination open itself up to the possibilities. Or you can say that there are spirits, who, friends, family members who love you, who have come down and to, just like they'd help you, haul your furniture away when you needed to move, they've come down and lend you a hand when you're writing a story.
That's amazing.
So,
but I have to believe it because I've read the book, and I could feel that. Ridley Pearson was on the program recently promoting Chain of Evidence,
and he
mentioned the rock bottom remainders. He said that you're involved with this. Could you tell us about it?
Yeah. Ridley and I actually do a duet together. That's our specialty. We sing a song that nobody really probably remembers, Mammer Jammer, but it's a wonderful song.
She's a bad Mammer Jammer?
Mammer Jammer. No, it's just called Mammer Jammer, and you got to do the Mammer Jammer if you want my love. This band was formed by a media escort named Kathy Goldmark in San Francisco, who actually went to Antioch College. Now, this is the kind of personality that comes out of Antioch. She is a really great friend of mine and has done all kinds of things. She used to be a girlfriend to one of the guys in the Steely Dan band back in the old days. But now she has this media escort service where she takes authors around to their appointments and things. And she also organized this band with Stephen King, Ridley Pearson, Dave Barry, Barbara Kingsolver, Robert Fulghum. The members of the band keep shifting. The core members are, you know, Stephen King and Dave Barry, Ridley Pearson, and Matt Groening, who many people mispronounce as Matt Groening, Matt Groening of the, who created The Simpsons and those wonderful cartoon books, Life is Hell, Childhood is Hell, Roy Blunt Jr. We have a whole bunch of really funny guys in our band, and the Kathy Goldmark and I, and another woman named Tad Bartimus, who's an AP bureau chief, we're the remainderettes. And we're, you know, it just really divides down to those old 60 notions of boys and girls. But we have a wonderful time. I don't really sing that well, but through Kathy and the band, I learned that if you don't have a lot of vocal talent, you can compensate by developing a lot of attitude. And if you think about it, you know, there are a lot of bands out there that don't necessarily have great vocal talent on the order of Pavarotti or Katie Lang. You know, it's the great costumes, great attitude, good choreography. So good wigs, you know, that's what I compensated with. My signature song is Boots. These boots are made for walking, which I hated when I was growing up. You know,
Nancy
this Nancy Sinatra,
Sinatra
song. And Nancy Sinatra, you know, she's popular now with her look, at least. Her look is in, you know, kind of that parted blonde, limp hair and the pale makeup with the dark circles under your eyes and the 60s clothing. Anyway, this song, These Boots Are Made for Walking, was a song that Al Cooper, who our musical director, chose for me.
Al Cooper from Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Blood, Sweat, and Tears and the Blues Project, right. And I was outraged. You know, we're a band that faxes each other. And I got this fax saying this is what I was going to sing. And I said, are you crazy? I hated that song, you know. And he said, but imagine our dear, sweet little Amy dressed in thigh-high boots and, you know, wielding a whip and all this kind of stuff. And Kathy faxed to me and said, well, it's a song with a lot of attitude, and of course you could sing that old standby Bye Bye Love. That's always cute. So I realized, yeah, I had to do something. And so I got the wigs and I got the whips and went down to our gay district in San Francisco and went shopping at the S&M stores.
Went down to the Castro.
The Castro, yeah. And asked for, you know, the dog collars and the wrist cuffs and the chains and the whole thing and transformed myself, slicked back my hair and put on the biker cap. And at the end of the song, the first time I sang it, I think it was about that time that all that stuff was happening in Singapore where an American boy was caught doing graffiti on cars and he was beaten.
From Dayton, Ohio.
Okay, so you know that this is what happens. And we had a lot of bad boys in our band. So at the end of my song, I would say, when Nancy says, are you ready, Boots? And then I'd say, bend over, boys, I'm sending you to Singapore. And then I would beat their butts on stage in front of thousands of people. And then everybody would go crazy. I mean, I guess it's the sight of somebody beating Stephen King's butt on stage, you know. And the guys loved it. We used to have such a good time on our bus tour, you know, or messages going back and forth. People having to deliver a message and looking at me says, Mr. Barry said that he would really love it if you would beat him tonight. You know, and people would be wondering now, what's happening with these these authors.
Just good, clean
fun.
Yeah,
good, clean fun.
Well, in San Francisco, you probably didn't raise that many eyebrows.
No, you know, we never played in San Francisco. We played on the East Coast. Well, part of us did. The remainders who played in San Francisco, we call ourselves the Remains. But the last gig we played at as a full band was actually in Cleveland. We were at the Cleveland Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Mm. And the night before the big show, we played at the gala in front of the record executives and some of the performers. And you can imagine how we felt, you know, knowing that Aretha and Elton John and people like that were out in the audience. And here we were singing, you know.
Oh, I'm sure they loved it.
You know, they had a good time because we were told that at a lot of these events, these fundraiser type events, you know, they'll have entertainment for the evening and stuff. And people usually eat up their chicken dinner and then leave. And they actually stayed and danced. We were a good dance band. I think we're the caliber of a good high school dance band. Yeah.
Well, we're really glad that you have a new book out. How long has it been since the last one came out?
Well, The Kitchen God's Wife came out in 91, I believe. But I don't want people to think I was just sitting on my duff, you know, not doing any work the last 4 years. I did two children's books. The Chinese Siamese Cat and the Moon Lady, which we'll also be signing tonight, and a movie, which took 2.5 years out of my life, you know, because I was a co-producer and a co-writer and was very much involved with the production and editing and marketing of that movie. In addition, I had written another book, but I discarded that. So I haven't been that lazy.
I'm not implying that.
When people say we've been waiting an awful long time, you know, it instills in a lot of writers who are neurotic anyway, you know, a lot of guilt and feelings of shame. And the second worst thing that we can hear is when you're at a book signing, you've just finished writing your book, and people say, so when's the next one coming out? You know, and then you're filled with anxiety again, you know.
I won't ask you that question.
You've been listening to the best of the Book Nook. That was Amy Tan, recorded back in 1995. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. You probably noticed that interview began with some music. And that was a CD that I was playing when Amy Tan came into the station. It was by a group called Adiemus. It was choral music, and she loved that CD. She got all excited about it when she came in, and she asked me about it and wanted information, and I thought, oh, well, I'm glad she liked it. And we had her back on the program a few years later for her next novel, and then one day I was at a convention in Chicago, a bookseller's convention, and I saw Amy Tan, Dave Barry, and Ridley Pearson coming across the room together. They were all members of the Rock Bottom Remainders, her band. And I saw her, and she came up to me, and I said, hi, Amy, how you doing? She says, oh, hi. She says, I remember you. And I said, oh, good, I'm glad you do. She says, yeah. She says, you turned me on to Adiemus. She actually remembered the name of the group. I was so impressed. And it was really wonderful to meet her in person that first time. We had a lovely day. Little Bubba Zoe didn't get hurt. That was nice. Her little Yorkie was just fine. She loved those little dogs. And she's still around. She's still writing, still living in San Francisco. And one of her books, her first novel, was one of the 100 best loved novels recently featured on PBS. And that was her 1989 The Joy Luck Club. For the Best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.